I wanted to be good. I wanted God to love me. I turn and everywhere I look, brilliant people, intelligent people are following these rules. Why can't I just fit in? Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is. What's wrong with me?
Boy, do I have an episode for you today. It's Julia Hart, who I think is a pretty big famous name. So I was very excited that she was willing and happy to come on this podcast. She even took the effort to go to a studio I picked out, which I do for people sometimes in New York, because I know a great studio there, New York. I always do that New York thing, and I'll stop doing that because it must annoy people from New York who say that doesn't sound like someone saying New York with our accent at all. Anyway, she's brilliant. She is a formerly, I think it's yeshiva, ultra-Orthodox Jewish woman. I mean, she's still a Jewish woman, but she's formerly yeshiva and ultra-Orthodox, which is, I suppose, a different type from Hasidic. We didn't really get into the weeds on that one, but she has this TV series called My Unorthodox Life, which really is like a cross between the Kardashians and some sort of religious thing. I guess just a religious... Well, she's not. The point is she's left, isn't it? But getting used to life on the outside. And she has this extremely beautiful family and very glamorous life. And she is the CEO of, or was the CEO of, Elite World Group. And there's a whole thing with a divorce and losing her, whatever. We didn't go into that because I wanted to go into the Haredi community, as they call it, which is her upbringing. It's just fascinating. She's incredibly smart and eloquent. Like, and I don't mean, oh, like, because she was in a cult, isn't it great that she can talk? Like, compared to anyone, she is super switched on and smart. And it was so great getting to talk to her. So I hope you guys enjoy it as much as I did, because her perspectives on life are just fascinating and unique. And that's what I do this podcast for. I hope that this helps to give a different perspective and insight into what it is to be free and an individual. And she has a book out called Brazen. It's phenomenal. It's written as beautifully as she speaks, and I really, really liked it. So I suggest people go and get it. It's the paperback launch at the moment. So just, you know, wherever you get your book, search for Brazen by Julia Hart and you will get hold of it. Big episodes are all coming up. I don't even know what order I'm in at the moment, except to say I've been really happy with a lot of the guests recently. So hope you guys are enjoying this episode. Do get in touch through Twitter, Instagram, and sign up for the Saturday episodes on patreon.com/AndrewGold. Then you get all the episodes ad-free as well. Come check out the YouTube as well. I do extra videos on there where I just sort of talk to the camera and do bits and pieces. We're about to hit, at the time of speaking, may have hit it by the time you look it up, 100,000 subscribers. So it's something to celebrate. But now you're on the edge of the Haredi community with Julia Hart. You are a fashion expert. How do I look? Do I look all right?
Got to stand up. I got to see the whole look.
Oh my God. But you won't be able to. And also, then, because I'm wearing tracksuit bottoms, you know, like,
what do you call it? That's a cheap question then. I don't know. I have to see the whole attire.
It doesn't look great.
I like the khaki sweater. It's very nice.
Phew. Okay. You found something to compliment. You look great as well. You've got the, what do you call that kind of thing? Like a cheetah thing?
Yeah. I guess animal print.
It looks fantastic.
Thank you, Dad.
I'm reading your book. I love it. It's what a brilliant book. Can I quote an early sentence back at you?
Anything. I'm literally an open book. I have actually an open book. So.
So this is from Brazen, and it's very early on. Okay. And you write, I walked into a world where no one knew me. I had no past, no shared history. I was a zero. Now I pursue zeros of a very different kind for thousands of women. What a great early line that is. And with that in mind, let's go back to the beginning. Tell me a little bit about your early days and how they were a little bit different from what most, I suppose, Westerners might have experienced.
Early days, are we talking in my old community or when I came out into this world?
I think old community. Let's start there.
Okay. So I think the easiest way to define the world I lived in is to watch Bridgerton or any of these, you know, movies or television shows about the 1700s and 1800s. Subtract the ball gowns, and the fabulous clothing, and you have my life. I lived an 18th century existence, right? Women are there to be wives and mothers. Their intellect is considered inferior to a man's. They are supposed to be covered head to toe and modest. In the olden days, if a woman slept around or, you know, was caught, you know, having an, you know, not being a virgin before she was married, that was it. She didn't get married. Her family was shamed. And that's my world. My world was a world where women and men had completely different roles and were treated very differently. In my world, when you wake up in the morning as a woman, you say a set of prayers. First one's very beautiful. Thank you, God, for giving me life and waking me up on this lovely day. And then you say to God, thank you for not making me a slave. And thank you for making me as you've chosen. A man, when he wakes up in the morning, he says, thank you for giving me life and waking me up. And his third prayer is, thank you for not making me a woman. That's the world I lived in. I wasn't a man, but I wasn't a slave. I was somewhere in between. But I had no autonomy. I didn't get to choose who I dated, how I dated, who I loved, what I wore, what I chose to put on my body, where I chose to do with my body, what profession I would have. My entire life was curtailed, and this, and it was, you know, a minuscule size, because it is my responsibility to prevent men from sinning.
You know what surprised me about your story? Because, you have all these, or one has all these ideas of what either a Hasidic or a yeshiva or ultra-Orthodox community might be like. But then the history of your parents seemed very different, because your father was a concert pianist and a communist in Russia. And your mum is like a genius with PhDs in maths and philosophy. So how does it go from that? And I know because I've read the book, but how does it go from that to what you experienced growing up?
So it's something, it's a question I have, you know, struggled with my whole life as I write in the book. You know, it's not a question I can ask my mother because, well, number one, she doesn't speak to me. And number two, she doesn't like talking about pre-religious life, right? Because that's something shameful that she tries to avoid at all costs. Our past was not something to ever be discussed in my family. So if you can imagine a PhD being something of shame.
Wow.
Yeah. The only explanation I can give for it is that both my parents, and especially my mother, were brought up on this concept that you need to live for something greater than yourself, that your own individual happiness is irrelevant to the greater good. That's communism, right?
Communism is
your individual happiness is irrelevant. It's the greater good that matters. And the more that you have to subsume and control your innate nature, the more you satisfy your purpose in life of suffering for the greater good. So my mother was educated on martyrdom. When I first wanted a divorce from my first husband in my community, and I told my parents I want out, my mother asked me why, and I said, because I'm not happy. And she said, well, who says you have to be happy? Where in the Torah does it say you need to be happy? Why do you think you deserve happiness? That's the idea. And so what did she choose? Think about communism. Communism is a religion. Communism tells you everything you have to do, what's right, what's wrong, right? And I write in my book about the fact that when I was a little bit older and I met this elderly Russian man in New York, and he was bemoaning how much he missed Mother Russia. When I asked him what he missed, he said, being told what to do. I hate having to make decisions, right? And so she left a religion, communism, where there was no self-autonomy, and your own self-interest didn't matter. And she chose a replacement that had the same set of rules. Fundamentalist Judaism is very similar to communism. The greater good, your own happiness doesn't matter. Everything is decided for you. No self-autonomy and martyrdom in the sake of the larger population. She chose a religion that mimicked communism almost down to its core details.
That's fascinating to think about the metaphor of, I guess, the communist Russia versus the individuality of America. And then they moved to America. And then it's so complex, isn't it? Because I guess they also suffered a great deal of anti-Semitism.
That's right.
There was this moment in Texas where you wanted to go to a particular school and you weren't able to because you were Jewish. So they must have felt even more like we need this sense of community and being away from Russia. And then you moved to Muncie, is it? So what's Muncie like?
Again, literally the 1800s, right? Women and baby with babies and baby carriages, men who do the, you know, work. Look, I worked. I was a high school teacher. But my money was not my own to control. I had to ask permission to spend it. Because, again, just like in the 1800s, a woman, she got married, the property immediately transferred to her husband. I mean, it's honestly, it's very simple. I lived an 18th century existence.
And was yours, this is something I won't go too far into it this time because I have done before it's a very difficult one. I mean, you've been criticized a bit by the Orthodox community. I've been criticized by some of the Orthodox community or just some Jewish people who feel attacked. Was your experience more extreme or do you think this is typical of different ultra-Orthodox sects?
Well, I'm going to read you something. And then I think you can answer the question for yourself.
Sure.
So when the show came out, I got a lot of criticism from the Orthodox community, much less so when the book came out, because when the book came out, what I did, because I got criticism on the show, is an accompaniment to the book, is brazenbook.com, the website. If you go on there, there's a link that takes you to hundreds of footnotes where I prove every word that I said in my book. So that's why there's almost zero criticism since the book came out. You don't really see any. The only articles that came out, all the criticism came from the show, because in the show wasn't about my past. The show was about my present, and it was mere little snippets of my past. So, for example, I got criticized for saying that I didn't watch movies when they're like, oh, but you did. And then I say, yes, at the very end I did. It took me 8 years to plan my escape, and in my mid-30s, once I decided I wanted to leave, that's when I started watching movies, you know, so forth and so on. So because the show was just little snippets and I couldn't prove any of the things I was saying because that's not what the show was about, I got criticized. When the book came out, because of that criticism, I said, you know what? I'm going to fact check and bring proof of every word I say about that community. And I did. It's hundreds of footnotes, hundreds of pages, reams and reams of proof for every law that I cite, for everything that I say happened to me. It's all there. And I'm just going to read one.
Go on.
Only because I think the biggest criticism I got was that the education I received was wonderful and commensurate with the 21st century, and I could have gone to college, and plenty of women from my school go to college, which is complete nonsense. I mean, genuine, actual nonsense. I learned nothing in high school. My education is not... It was so subpar to the worst public school in this country. For biology, I learned Hilchos Lashon Hara, which is laws of proper speech. I mean, we had a class called biology. We had a class called chemistry. I never went into a single chem. We had an actual chemistry lab. We never walked into it. We never did anything there. I'd never once stepped.
Is that for appearances, for in case it gets inspected?
Appearances, because not just appearances, but for government funding, right? To get government funding, you need to have chemistry. You need to have biology. So they have a chemistry lab that I've never once used. I never touched a beaker. I never used a droplet. I know nothing about chemistry. I was taught zero.
There's a story in your book, isn't there, of one of your classmates who wanted to go to college and asked for her records, and they wouldn't give them to her and locked the school so
That's
she couldn't like, go in and get them.
That's correct. My daughter couldn't get her transcript. I had to go through crazy machinations just to force the school to give my daughter her transcript. And the school that finally complied was not the school she went to. We had to do this whole craziness where she had to retake certain tests in a more modern Orthodox high school so that she could graduate high school and They would send her the transcripts. I mean, what I had to go through to just get her marks, her grades that she earned, was madness. So all of that, I was called a liar and how wonderful. And then they found, like, there's this one doctor and one lawyer. Congratulations. Yes, there are two people in my community with degrees. That doesn't mean the schools educate you. So someone sent me a letter from Beis Yaakov, right? It's a system of schools. I went to a Beis Yaakov. There's Beis Yaakovs in Muncie and Brooklyn, and every community, religious community, has this Beis Yaakov. And I want to read you the letter, because here's what it says. Dear parents, in the last years, it's becoming increasingly prevalent for high school girls to be preparing themselves and working towards a college degree while in high school. Now, this is from 2020. Okay, so in the last few years, so clearly not when I was in high school. Right? In the last few years, all of a sudden, there's this terrifying trend that women are trying to go to college. Now, wait. Now, you're going to see what kind of college they're talking about. They're not talking about Princeton or Harvard. They're talking about online schools or religious colleges where you still learn the same subjects with the same people. Okay? Listen to this. This is not the reason Klal Yisrael is the Jewish people, have established Beis Yaakov schools for Benos Yisrael, for girls. And it is not in line with a Beis Yaakov chinuch. It is not in line with a Beis Yaakov education. College is not in line with our education. Black and white, you can see it on the brazenbook.com website. It's there. This is not my word. It is the school itself saying, we do not prepare girls to go to college. And it continues. This is not the reason it's established school. A Torah chinuch, a Torah education, does not mean the subjects they are learning. It means that they are connecting and drawing life from one source only, which is Torah. Can't go to college. College is not Torah. Okay. Beis Yaakov schooling was established to give our Bnos Yisrael, our young women, a direct connection to Torah. It was to become the sole source of their learning and connection to life. To have them then connected to college in any form, which is an independent source, or should we say an outside source, during those years that were set aside for them to draw life from Torah learning only, is not to their benefit, is detrimental and antithetical to Beis Yaakov schooling. Now, does that sound like a school that you can go to college from?
No, it sounds completely crazy.
It sounds completely crazy. The fact that college courses, and now we're going to define what kind of college they're talking about. They're not talking about girls going to Stanford University. No one from Beis Yaakov is going to Stanford, right? Here's the colleges that they describe. The fact that the college courses may be Chumash, Halacha, etc. These are Jewish courses, Bible study, Torah law, or subjects they have already learned. Meaning these are not real colleges. These are these, I don't want to say BS colleges. These are tangential colleges where religious studies are given accreditation. Okay?
Yeah.
Does not change the fact that they are in college. For all purposes, once your daughter has connected herself to college, she has disconnected herself from Torah learning to that and only that which is her only source in life. If your daughter is presently preparing for or taking any college courses or tests for college, please make an appointment to discuss with us. And then on the bottom, you have to fill out, if you can see, these two little checks. And the two little checks, one check says, my daughter is not taking any college courses or preparatory tests. The second check says, my daughter is taking college courses or preparatory tests. I would like to set up an appointment. So
you're going to tell me
that I exaggerated? No, I told the truth. People don't like the truth. You know why? Because it points fingers and says, hey, something is wrong.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on what could go right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, that's what I have to remind myself as well, because I don't like being criticized. It doesn't feel good. And I have this nature sometimes, maybe naivety, where I go, oh God, maybe I got this wrong. And then I have to remind myself, well, these are people from within what I would consider a very insular community, or very defensive people, at least. But I guess another point that some of them are making, and perhaps wrongly, it's not that you exaggerate. They're saying, but yours was a very extreme college, for example. So give me an idea. Is this widespread across, let's say, the American and British ultra-Orthodox communities?
This is the main source of schooling for women in any Black Hat ultra-Orthodox community. It's Beis Yaakov. There are Beis Yaakov schools in London, in Manchester, in Golders Green. They're all over the world. It is the central core message and system of the ultra-Orthodox schooling education for women, that their only purpose in life is to be wives and mothers, and the only education they received should be from their Jewish high school, period. That's a fact. It is a fact. My story is not unique or extraordinary in any way, shape, or form. And to say that it's something that I experience but other women don't is just factually inaccurate. Now, what you can say is other women experience it and they don't mind. They're happy being wives and mothers. And here's what I always say to that. This isn't a happiness contest. This is an equality issue. Happy or not, the question is it equitable or is it not? Are the laws fair or are they not? And I always say this to people. When suffragette movement came through, in the UK, in the US, was it only men attacking the suffragettes?
No.
No.
No, plenty of women.
It was millions of women, millions. And what did they say? We're happy. We love being wives and mothers. We don't need the right to vote. And yet, their daughters are very grateful that the women who marched did. And that's what I say. The women of my generation may say to themselves, I'm used to not having these rights. I'm okay. I'm happy. But I'm going to fight for their daughters and their daughters' daughters, whether they like it or not.
Julia, I love how you talk. Where does this eloquence come from? I suppose you're genius parents to an extent. Is that where it comes from?
Well, you know, I had to educate myself, right? I received really no education. I received a 17th century education. And so the only way to... It's a very, as you saw in the book, it's not like I decided one morning I'm out and I just walk out the door. It took me years, 8 years of educating myself, of trying to familiarize myself with a world that was 300 years out of anything I understood. I'm a true time traveler. I knew nothing about the outside world. And by the way, that's why most people who leave my community do end up committing suicide. Do have substance abuse issues because we are not equipped to handle the 21st century. We were not taught to handle the 21st century. You cannot imagine how disconcerting and disorienting and confusing it is to walk into a world you don't recognize. In my world, women aren't allowed to live alone. You go from your father's house to your husband's house. To come into a world where women had any autonomy was really shocking to me. The first time I slept in a room by myself, I was 42 years old. It's hard for people to conceive of such a thing. And so it's either just to call me a liar or an exaggerator than to realize that it's true and it's happening in our century.
Well, the rest of us don't think you're a liar. I just want to clarify that. It's just those people.
I appreciate that. No, it's just hurtful because it's like... It's the trauma of having to have lived through it and then having someone try to negate your experience and say, no, that never happened, which is just ludicrous. And I think, you know, the way that I survived that transition is through reading. Words are my lifeline. So I think to answer your question in terms of my speaking and why I write books, well, a book, and I have the show and I do everything that I do, it's because knowledge is power. Knowledge is the key to everything. And education, to me, if these women in my world are educated, the day that they realize that they deserve more is the day that we change the world together.
That's beautifully put, Julia. And you know what? I'm writing a book about the psychology of secrets and how secrets are used against people. And there is a section I'm doing about religion and cults and things. And I'm going to quote you in there, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. But, I'm happy to.
There's a real similarity between, you know, the creation story, Adam and Eve, and the tree of knowledge, and they have to be careful not to get any knowledge. That's the worst thing you can have. And then there was this scene in your book about a classmate whose family had a television. And then the teacher was sort of smelling it. Can you tell us about
this
that?
Oh, this is amazing. So, okay, TVs, so you have to understand, fundamentalism can only exist in isolation, right? So the outside world has to be the enemy and dangerous. You can't have a television. The television is too connective to the outside world. I'm sitting in class one day and my principal comes in and everyone was frightened of her. She's a very brilliant, very, very charismatic and powerful woman. She comes in and she says, "I smell tuma." And we're like, oh my God. Tuma means impurity, rot. And we're all looking around like, oh my gosh, I smell tuma. And we're just shaking in our seats. And she points to a girl in my class and she says, "You have brought tuma into this class. You have brought tuma into this school. You have brought tuma into your classmates." And this poor girl is sitting there now and she's white as a ghost and shaking hysterically. Why? How did she bring impurity into the classroom? There is a television in your home. You must go home tonight. You must take an axe and you must chop, chop, chop the television.
God.
That's what we were talking about.
Because it almost sounds funny to hear you do it as like the impersonation years later.
But it was how very terrifying. Frightening. It was not funny. We were terrified. Terrified. People didn't talk to
her. Does anyone have an axe at home? Is that a normal thing to keep at home?
I don't know. That was literally what she said. Verbatim.
It's the TV of knowledge, isn't it? It's the tree of knowledge. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing. Education is dangerous. When I started dating, I was warned, Julia, because not only was I not allowed to read secular things, right? I wasn't allowed to read most of the religious, books, farim, that are in my community. And I was constantly being told, Julia, you shouldn't have read this. You shouldn't have known that. You shouldn't have looked into that. Don't tell your husband or the person you're about to go out with that you know these things. You're never going to get married.
Just ignorance is celebrated.
Ignorance is celebrated. When I taught in high school, my first high school, and one of the teachers saw my lesson plan, she said, "Oh, are you having problems at home?" And I said, "Sorry, what do you mean?" She's like, "Well, this is way too erudite. You're going to make your husband feel insecure."
Every like cult and extreme religion seems to turn into like a boys' club eventually.
These
guys all just sort of make it so it's as comfortable as possible for them.
Yeah.
And so you can suppress the women. I mean, it is sad. And you know what's maybe surprising for people who have not experienced something like that, but you know, reading your book, it makes sense, of course, is that it seems like a lot of this stuff you didn't just, go along with when you were young. You enjoyed and got pleasure from, you know, the modesty and that kind of thing.
I wanted to be good. I wanted God to love me. I wanted to please everyone around me. And even more than that, I turn and everywhere I look, brilliant people, intelligent people are following these rules. So I kept thinking to myself, what's wrong with me? Why can't I just fit in? Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is. It's what God wants for me. What's wrong with me? That it was I always assumed that something was inherently wrong with me, that I couldn't be okay with these. And I do want to point out one thing, because I am saying a lot of negative things, and I want to stop for a second and say a few positive things as well. So I've had two things happen recently that have given me tremendous hope. What I always say to people is, look, I love being Jewish. I'm proud to be a Jew. And I don't think there's no malicious intent. I always say everyone in my story is a victim, because they're taught these things. They think it's right as well. Until we change the laws, they're as much a prisoner as I am.
I guess it's a good point to remind listeners who have no experience of Judaism and Jewish people and stuff that, firstly, this is a very small percentage of Jews in general.
Tiny percentage. It's the most extremist version of religious Jews. And most religious Jews live very modern lives. They're modern Orthodox. They go to college. They have televisions. They live a perfectly normal existence, and I have tremendous respect for them. And all the things that I'm saying absolutely do not apply in those communities. That's number one. Number two, in my community, I love the people in my community. I just want them to have it all. I want them to be able to be religious and not be downtrodden and minimized and enslaved because they're women. I don't want to attack. I want to make their lives better. And I think that it may be starting. And I'm going to tell you something that happened to me recently that I almost fainted. I was so shocked. So I don't want to name the place because it might give away who this person is. I was in a location. So this very famous rabbi that every single person in the Hasidic or black hat world knows. Even if you're living in Austria, if you're a black hatter, you know who this guy is. It's a small world, right? We're all interconnected. One of the most famous people in my world. And he starts walking toward me. And okay, rabbis that are that big, they travel with an entourage, right? So he's got his shamish and his people who are always around him. And I see them heading towards me. I'm like, oh no, here I was gonna go. I'm gonna get yelled at that I'm a this and a that. And why can't I keep my mouth shut? And blah, 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 blah. I'm like, oh my God. And I'm literally stealing myself for an attack. And he comes over with his whole posse. And he looks down on me, because I'm tiny, and he says, Ms. Hart, my wife and my daughters thank you.
No.
Yeah, and walked away. You understand, it took me probably 40 seconds to recover. Every time I think about it, I burst out crying, because this is a man who could actually affect change. This is someone who can actually do something about it. And if he's coming to me and saying, my wife and daughters, thank you, that means my message is getting across. Because I love Judaism. I love the people in my community. I want them to have it all. And if I have awoken some people to say, wait a minute, maybe we aren't treating women properly. Maybe these are laws that need to change. Maybe women will be happier to be religious if we don't push them down every day.
Yeah. So but maybe I guess my concern with that isn't in some sense it seems incompatible, because you talk of the prayers right from the moment you wake up. The prayers already make an inequality between the sexes.
But there's a lot of things that have been changed in the last couple hundred years. For example, there used to be a law. I know it's going to sound crazy, but it's not in today's day and age. There used to be a law that if a woman was raped, her rapist would be forced to marry her. Can you imagine? Now, what woman in her right mind would want to marry her rapist? Okay? But go back 3,000-4,000 years and think about what a woman with a child alone, unmarried, would be forced to do.
Yeah. Awful.
And it's right. So my point is, there are laws that existed back then that they have repealed now. Obviously, in today's day and age, there is no law in even the most extreme ultra-Orthodox community that a woman should marry her rapist. That law has been negated, right? So there are many laws that got thrown out because they don't apply to today's time. I'm not asking for something that has not happened before. There's multiple laws that have changed. For example, pre-Babylonian times, men could marry 10 women. You could have as many wives as you want. Nowadays, that's not the case. So there are many laws that have changed as times have progressed. I'm just asking for these laws to go, for those prayers to be gone. Prayer, by the way, prayer has been changed so many times I can't even begin to tell you, right? It was first said orally, and then it was put in writing, and then it was put in writing twice. And then when people were illiterate, the chazan had to read it, and people just say amen because half of the religious, you know, world in Eastern Europe couldn't read. So they couldn't read the prayers. So things have changed, and, you know, it has elasticity, right? It has some elasticity there. So I'm just asking for that elasticity to being used to women.
You know what I wanted to ask you? So in the community you grew up in, what would they think of a Jewish man, secular atheist man like myself?
Lost soul, darling. They you know, look, again, going back to the 18th century example, go to like Regency England or pre-revolution France, right? Lineage is all that mattered. And your lineage is, if when your family came to the Golden Medina, to the United States, they kept their religion, there they have lineage, they have royalty in their blood, right? In my community, royalty is how many rabbis you've got in your family tree, okay? If your family came, like your family, where is your family from originally?
Ukraine, Russia, those okay. kinds of places.
So when they came to the UK, they left religion. They became irreligious at some point, correct?
Yeah.
So people like you and me, whose families, whose ancestors left religion, we're like lesser beings.
Oh.
Okay.
Even worse than non-Jewish people, or about the same?
Different, because non-Jewish people are just, you know, or non-Jews. We don't bother with those guys. Jewish people, you're considered a tinok shenishba, which means a captive child, meaning you're a sinner against your own will because you just weren't educated properly. So it's not really your fault. So, you know, you're kind of like this nebulous, sad Jew kind of thing because you are a sinner. You eat non-kosher, you're polluting your body, you're angering God, but it's not your fault. You were kind of you're like a captive child. You know, you didn't know any better. So it's like a child raised in captivity who was not taught about Torah. Therefore, it's not really his fault. So you're something to pity. You're someone to pity. That's basically the concept. And you know how like in the olden days, women, heiresses from the United States would marry British aristocracy to get, so my community, the same thing. If you're like me or you, where you grew up irreligious, and so you don't have that nobility of and royalty of all these rabbis in your background, you need to have a lot of money to clean the shame of that and to marry into a royal rabbinic family. That's how it works. So for example, my brothers and my younger sister all married rabbinic royalty because by the time my siblings were getting married, my parents had so much money that they were able to buy into rabbinic families. It wow. works exactly like it did in the 1800s.
Okay, so then, and when you left, right, that must have caused a bit of a scene. You say you don't get on with your parents now. So, I mean, how was that? This must have been mad for everyone
insane.
Around you.
Well, first of all, nobody saw it coming. Nobody. I didn't tell a single human being. I never spoke my doubts. I never voiced my misery. I was too afraid because, well, first of all, people already thought I was crazy. I was already a rebel because, again, you know, it was a slow, gradual transformation. So before I left, I was already watching movies openly and going to movie theaters, and there was no more stockings. And so I was already really, really skating on thin ice. So if I would have told people I'm out or I'm planning to leave, who knows what would have happened? They would have taken away my kids. I don't know what would have happened. So I told no one. So when I walked out the door, everyone was flummoxed completely. They thought I'd lost my mind. Here was this woman. She was a high school teacher for 20 years. You know, she taught all this Chumash, Torah, Navi, Halacha, Chamesh, Megillah, Parsha, all this stuff. And all of a sudden she turns around. She's like, bye. I mean, no one, and to everyone, it seemed, in you know, what's his name? Who's that brilliant investor dude? Who says
Elon
like
Elon Musk?
No. Who said that, you know, everyone always says I became a billionaire overnight. They just don't realize overnight took 40 years. they didn't realize that I'd been planning this for 9 years. I'd been educating myself for 9 years.
Wow.
I mean, this was a very long, long process. To them, it was 1 minute she's religious, the next minute she's not. And no one understood what was going on. And at first people just thought I'd literally had like a mental breakdown. And they're like, she's just lost her mind. And then people realize, oh, no, she hasn't lost her mind. She's out.
And how was your mother?
Well, my parents haven't spoken to me since the day I walked out the door. Not one word.
But the whole thing's a bit weird. And I've always said this, and I get, again, it's another thing I get shouted at for. And it's that I've said that although, I shouldn't repeat it because I'll get shouted at more. But I've said that, you know, there's this idea of maternal and paternal love for the children. And I do believe in it, but it's amazing when you talk to people from extreme religions and cults and things, how easily it seems to be broken. And for example, your birthdays, you would just be like, you know, it's my birthday today. And they just didn't even remember. And they left you at home when they went on holidays to look after like all the other children. It was like this sort of Cinderella kind of thing.
I did not have a fun childhood, but again, who says you have to have a fun childhood? Who says you have to be happy, right?
Well, yeah.
That's their basic, that was their philosophy. Their philosophy is you are put on this earth to serve.
Wow.
Period. So if you're put on this earth to serve, go serve.
But do you feel like they loved you?
It's a tough question. You know, my mother, my, yeah, you know, there's me and then there's 10 years gap and then there's seven other children, right? So I was basically their mommy. My sister Hannah, who's closest in age to me, is 10 years younger than I. And she was originally the only person in my family who spoke to me when I left. But now she doesn't speak to me either because her community gave her an ultimatum. It's us or your sister. And she chose her community.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's hurtful, but I understand it, you know? So we did this thing for a year. When she was living in Miami and I was living in Atlanta, we did this thing where every time we spoke to my mother, so this is when I'm still in the community, right? But my mother already didn't approve of me because I was too modern Orthodox. I was, as you saw, I started reading secular literature. I started arguing with people. My skirts came a little bit higher. My stockings came a little bit lower, you know. So as I became progressively more modern, my mother became very, you know, disappointed in me. And for one full year, we would end every conversation with my mother with an I love you to see if she would ever say it back. And in a year of ending every conversation with her with I love you, she never said it back, not once. So do I think she loves me? I think she loves me as much as she's capable of loving a person. I think she loves ideals and religion more.
How does that make you feel now? Have you sort of just gone, forget it, that's a different thing, or do you dwell on it?
No, I mean, does it hurt? Of course it hurts. I miss my family. I miss my siblings. I raised them. I changed their diapers. I did their homework. I put them to sleep. They literally called me mommy. These are people I raised. And now they don't speak to me because I'm this terrible sinner. So of course it hurts. I miss them. But I have zero anger. Literally none. Because it's not their fault. They're victims too. They're indoctrinated and brainwashed. They think they're doing the right thing. They truly believe that to associate with me would be damaging for their souls. They're doing what they're taught is right. How can I fault them for that? I can't.
And I gather that was partly why, I mean, there's a part in the book, you have these struggles with leaving and perhaps contemplating even taking your life and wondering what that would do to the people you left behind.
I mean, it seemed easier to kill myself than to walk into the 21st century. It's so hard to explain to people. It's like saying to you, you have to go to Mars now. Go to Mars. Go figure it out. It's really terrifying. And it's even more terrifying at 42. to go to Mars and learn a new language and a new culture and people that are so foreign to you that they really feel like another group of humanity. I mean, I didn't know anyone outside of my community. You know, I was afraid of non-Jews, if you can imagine such a thing. I was really afraid of them.
But it's so mad, though, to think of you back then. And then you didn't just, like, assimilate. You sort of dominated that whole world. You become, like, the CEO of a huge fashion industry. You've got, like, this Kardashians TV series. Like, you absolutely smashed it. Like, well, how does that
happen?
Go big
or go home, baby. I mean, I figured, look, if I can time travel, I can do anything.
Yeah. Nothing matters anymore. It's
nothing
like a different,
matters anymore.
Like you say, you're on Mars now. You might as well just play the game.
That's it. If I'm, you know, and also I think, you know, before my marriage went south, my husband used to say you were in a pressure cooker. And when that lid came off, you just exploded because that's what it was. For so many years, everything I had inside of me, all my skills and capabilities and talents and everything I thought and wanted to achieve, I was told that all of that was evil and wrong to even think about. So the minute I was given the autonomy to work, I couldn't stop. You know, when people ask me what is my favorite thing to do in my new world, it's work. It's not party or go to clubs or date or any, it's working, it's achieving, it's changing things, it's creating, it's inventing. This is what gives me life. And I can't stop. I need it. It gives me so much joy.
What were some of the bits that when you first came out were the most sort of alien? And I always use this example. There was a woman called Emily Green who got out of the Hasidic community in London, and she said she went to a job interview for quite a highbrow job, I think it was, and she was wearing jeans, and that's why she didn't get the job. And she didn't understand that jeans were different to suit trousers and stuff like that, which I always use that example because it blows my mind. Like, of course, what, that makes
how
sense now.
Know? But
yeah. What were some of the things like that for you?
Oh, gosh. I mean, literally everything. I think, you know, I'd never heard of a contract. Like, in my world, you just shake hands because your next door neighbor's related to their cousin's uncle's brother. And if they mess with you, then you're in synagogue to get, you know what I mean? There's very little in many of these kind of deal structures. It's all a handshake. Like, my first partners, we wrote our thing on a napkin. I just assumed when I paid someone something, that was it. They knew they would get paid. I didn't realize you have to have a sign off and that the invoice has to be stamped and paid and sent back so that you have proof that you paid it. And so people would say, oh no, you didn't pay it. And I'd be like, yes, I did. And they're like, show me proof. And I'd be like, So people took tremendous advantage of my lack of understanding of these kind of things, and it's still kind of biting me in the ass now. I still realize that my current husband fooled me a lot when it comes to contracts, because it's not something I was very cognizant of or familiar with. And then in the personal space, everything. Like, my first boyfriend, I've had one boyfriend, right? I'm 51 years old, I've had one boyfriend because left my marriage, you know, there's no boyfriends before I got married, and then I just wanted to experience, I had a sexual revolution of my own, right? And then I had a boyfriend, and then I met my husband. So I've had literally one boyfriend. And I remember when we first became like official girlfriend, I didn't know what that meant. I literally sat him down and said, okay, are there rules? Like, are we supposed to talk every day now? Am I supposed to text you? Like, I didn't know what to do. Like, what is a girlfriend supposed to do? What's normal? What's not normal? What should I expect? What should I not expect? What should he expect? Like, I was literally telling you, tell me what a girlfriend does. I had no clue.
You know what, though? In most respects, you're right in that you are at a disadvantage in those things. But there's also a slight advantage, because the rest of us also don't really know what anything means and what we're doing. And, oh, are we exclusive? Are we together? I don't know about contracts and invoices and things. But I can't ask, because I'm a 33, nearly 34-year-old man who should already know what I'm doing. So I can't really ask. Whereas you can now, because, you know, you can sit down and say, hey, you know, explain this to me exactly how it is, and then you can learn.
That's true. That's true. I'm an eternal student, you know, and it just, you don't even realize like so many of these little things, and also just pop culture knowledge. As much as I started watching TV when I planned my escape, I watched for a few years, right? I was invited to this event by Kering, you know, who owns like Gucci and Kering Group. So there's like LVMH and then there's Kering. And they invited me to this screening of Thelma and Louise. With Thelma and Louise, with Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis. And, cool. You know, they were going to speak about it, and it was the anniversary of when it came out and blah, blah, blah. And we're in this theater in Manhattan, this small theater, and the movie's playing, and people are talking. People are whispering. And I'm sitting going, shh, shh. And the person sitting next to me is like, my God, you would think you'd never seen this movie. And I'm like, I've never seen this movie.
I thought you were going to say that you shushed Susan Sarandon, not knowing who she was.
I have done things like that. I'll tell you a massively embarrassing. Well, no, I probably should not say this on.
Please do.
No, it's just, you know, because again, there are just so many holes in my understanding of pop culture knowledge, what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. I just don't know. And I learn as I go. And I make a lot of really embarrassingly silly mistakes. That are pretty, pretty bad.
I feel like you were going to tell me one.
I was going to tell you one, but then I realized I'm just saying it publicly and it's so embarrassing.
You really don't want to tell us? Me.
I'll kind of synopsize it a little bit so I don't sound overly stupid. So let's just say that people that I should have recognized and known in the UK and how to appropriately speak to them and, you know, what the proper words to call them by, I really stuck both feet in my mouth and then swallowed them whole because I had no idea how to deal with any kind of royalty or non-royalty relationship kind of things. So I made an absolute fool of myself. And I luckily was able to say, not only am I an American, so please forgive me, I'm also come from a really, you know, isolated community. So I'm just doubly stupid.
What did you do to the Queen, Julia?
No, I didn't do anything to the Queen. Okay, gosh, I can't believe I'm telling you this story out loud. Well, here we go. I am involved in the elephant family. Travels to my elephant. I help. I love this charity. It's called Elephant Family. It helps save the Asian elephant. And there are members, you know, King Charles and Camilla, Queen Camilla, and many members of the family are very involved in this because they've really taken on this as one of their charities. And I raised some money and they threw this cocktail event that I came to, and they did this beautiful video for me and made this entire presentation. And, you know, I didn't know, usually when you're invited to a cocktail party and you're told the cocktail party starts at 7, what would you think? When do you go?
You come at like 7:30.
7:30. Okay, you don't do that if the people inviting you are part of the royal family.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, neither did I. And I made a complete ass of myself because I come 45 minutes late and I wanted to sink through the floor. I felt so embarrassed. And they were so lovely and so kind and so, I mean, just so generous to me. And, you know, they made me feel not as stupid as I felt. They couldn't have been nicer. They smiled at my ignorance and were just so elegant about it. And they're like, Julia, no, don't worry. We understand. I'm like, I'm so sorry. I'm an American. I don't know anything. And I just felt so badly because they were so generous with their time. And I felt really stupid. So yeah, I get into situations like this all the time.
Well, most of us don't know what to do around. I wouldn't know what to do around them.
I didn't know. I'm English. So bad. Had I known that, and that they had made a whole video for me and were giving me a presentation award, and I missed my own video, my own presentation. Embarrassing. Like, so dumb. Anyway.
It's a cool story to have now, isn't it? That's a good way to look at it. We've got a couple minutes left. Just tell me a little bit about, I mean, how's Bathsheba?
And just to make it clear, it wasn't Prince Charles and Camilla that were giving me the award. It was a different member of the royal family that was going to present it. And I don't want to embarrass this particular, I mean, not that it's embarrassing, to the contrary, she was lovelier than any human being deserved after I've messed it up. I'm trying to leave names out because I don't want to get into any situations, but the people that I have met have been beyond lovely to me, and I'm so grateful to all of them. They've been so kind to me, and really appreciative.
I'm pleased to hear that. We've got a couple, just in the last couple minutes, I just want to hear about, is there any more My Unorthodox Life coming up? And how's, how are the kids? How's Bathsheba? She's got a social media influencer career. Looks great, her Instagram page.
Kids are great. I can't talk about Netflix until Netflix talks about Netflix. But kids are doing really well. Miriam's back in Stanford, even though she graduated already. She's taking some other classes there. Bathsheba is killing it in, her career. Shlomo is working with me on Plus Body, my shapewear company that we're about to relaunch. We had to put a pause on it because of my whole divorce thing, but now we're coming back strong. I'm really, really excited about it. So he works with me every day. And I love my kids. I'm really lucky.
Oh, they're fantastic. And the show is fantastic. The book is fantastic. Please, everyone, go out and get Brazen. Brazen is out in the UK. Did it get released later in the UK?
I think it got released the same day. It's the paperback book cover. The paperback is coming to UK before it comes to US.
Oh, that's what it is. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's the most phenomenal book. Really insightful and unique. And I encourage everyone to go out and buy a copy and to watch My Unorthodox Life on Netflix, because that's just fascinating to watch and fun as well. Julia, thank you for being on The Edge.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Julia Hart, so, so, so much. Wow, she is a professional. She's a pro. I didn't mention at the beginning, but we had all sorts of tech problems, probably on my side, something to do with my internet. Well, these things happen all the time anyway. It's why I'm trying to do more of these in person. And if I'm ever in New York again, I'm definitely looking Julia up, and maybe we can do an in-person, another interview, because that would be really fun. But she just powers through it. She's so, like I say, switched on. She's fascinating. I'm a big fan, obviously. I'm just sycophanting here. I'm just really, really, really I just like what she does and what she stands for, and I think she's great. Her family is great as well. Check out My Unorthodox Life on Netflix. It's really, it's just great TV. And it's, if you think the Kardashian stuff might be a bit superficial, well, this is really interesting, because it's just, it's the cult stuff. She's left, she's on the outside world, and she's getting to grips with it and how to raise her children in that world. It's fascinating, as is her book, Brazen, which is now out in paperback in the UK first, I think, the paperback part. But it's out everywhere. Wherever you are, check out Brazen. Go get it. Keep up with the podcast. I'll see you next time.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.